from your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to a new episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Thursday night, May 29th, as we record this episode. The Chicago White Sox are on their way to Baltimore after losing 2 of 3 to the New York Mets. Even though it's another series loss, the White Sox played the Mets tough. They couldn't hold a one-run lead late on Monday. You could make the case the White Sox could have won this series. We'll recap what went down in Queens as the transformation of Miguel Vargas is now capturing nationwide attention. Who is this version of Adrian Hauser, and how do the White Sox steal him from everyone else? And of course, the bullpen. The White Sox also made a trade this week by dealing catcher Matt Theis to Tampa for Drew Baker, and we'll preview what is the battle of the worst teams in the American League. Considering the MLB draft lottery at the end of the season, do the White Sox really want to win these games in Baltimore? I'll make the case why we shouldn't worry about lottery position in May. Let's get started. Joining me is the managing editor of SoxMachine.com. It's Jim Margulis. As if you guys get a chance, you can wish James Fegan, our beat reporter, a belated happy birthday. Happy birthday, James. As you listen to this, we wish you the best, bud. Jim, the White Sox go to Queens. They lose 2 out of 3. They lost game 1, 2-1. Lost game 2, 6-4. But won game 3 pretty decisively, 9-4. What are your thoughts about how the White Sox played against the Mets this week?
I think a lot of people were fearing the Cubs series of just like a superior team on paper with a lot of name brand offensive weapons going off on a White Sox staff that is overwhelmed and always battling regression and not missing bats. And that really wasn't the case, aside from like Jonathan Cannon in the first inning, giving up a pair of 2-run homers in game 2. But otherwise, the pitching staff seemed to do a decent job. Shane Smith probably had like the toughest time overall in terms of just start to finish battling inefficiency. But even then, like, he was able to, well, one, he was staked to a lead, but also he was able to avoid collapsing. And then Mike Vassell came in, like, I guess, you know, the night before of Jonathan Cannon getting through 5 and only needing Jared Schuster to get through the last 2 games, like all hands were on deck for game 3. So it was kind of like a good team effort in terms of like a good team loss in game 2 with Jonathan Cannon saying like, I'll get you into the 6th and, you know, save Will Venable from having to go to the bullpen too early. Game 1, I think, is probably just the, you know, perhaps the one frustrating one in terms of the bullpen not protecting a 1-run lead, but also this is a case where you can't really blame the bullpen because they would have had to shut out the Mets to win. And I think it's always unreasonable to expect a shutout no matter what, unless, like, you know, you're expecting to protect a 1-run lead. But even then, like, the White Sox were 0-10 with runners in scoring position. Seemed like game 3 Wednesday was regression for game 1. Like, it all washes out the same, but in the, yeah, you know, they could have used just one of those hits in game 1. All of a sudden, it's a different outcome. So all in all, I think it's like a fairly competent series. Probably would be a little bit easier to take had they just not blown a 1-run lead or had a 1-run loss because they blew a lead against the Rangers to close out that series. But you can see a lineup taking shape. You know, for all their problems with the runners in scoring position, they did produce chances, which a White Sox lineup is not always capable of doing. So not bad, all in all. And I think it's a pretty good test passed in terms of being able to shake off, you know, a real ugly series like the Cubs and then just string together, like, you know, they pitched okay against the Rangers. They pitched okay against the Mariners, you know, even though they've been losing 2 out of 3 at both Mariners and the Mets, like there are cases of them just giving the offense a chance to win. And then that offense having a better chance to win those games.
Yeah. I thought the White Sox played the Mets tough. Now, did they play well against the Mets? That's debatable. The Mets didn't play all that great of baseball against the White Sox themselves in these 3 games, but they played them tough. I was one of those, Jim, that feared the White Sox were going to get boat raced in Queens, and it would have been embarrassing three games. White Sox fans wouldn't think twice about it because the Mets should be one of the best teams in Major League Baseball just on paper with their roster. But the White Sox played the Mets tough, and I think that is something that White Sox fans and even the White Sox themselves could take away from Queens. They were able to get one out of three, and now they head to Baltimore. They could still make this what I would consider a successful road trip if they could win that series in Baltimore. We'll preview that series later in the show, but one of the guys that continues to hit for the White Sox, and it's this amazing transformation, and I mentioned the intro, now it's gaining attention nationwide. And I was watching MLB Network on Wednesday night, Jim, and they did a segment about Miguel Vargas. And they put up this slide as far as a graphic. In the first 64 games for Miguel Vargas, he batted just 117 with the White Sox and slugged just 182 with two homers and 13 RBIs. In his first 64 games with the White Sox, Vargas had a 21 weighted runs created plus and was worth negative 1.6 WAR on Fangraphs. Updating the numbers before we recorded this episode, Jim, in his last 31 games, Vargas is hitting 316. He's slugging over 600. He's got eight homers and 20 RBIs. His weighted runs created plus is 179, and he's been worth 1.6 WAR on Fangraphs. So in 31 games, Vargas has hit well enough, Jim, and defensively has been doing well enough to climb out of this hole that he dug for himself in his first 64 games with the White Sox, where now he's back to zero WAR. From what we have seen in the last 31 games, one, are you sold on Vargas, Jim? And two, should White Sox fans consider Vargas part of a new core during this rebuild?
I think I'm sold on Vargas in terms of him being a contributor. Like, I don't know if what he's been doing is the new norm or if it's just a matter of some regression was necessary, because even in the first few weeks of this season, some of the contact was good and he wasn't rewarded for it. Some of it was weather-based. Some of it was just not having like the oomph behind a swing. But there, you know, he should have been hitting as poorly as he's hitting. So, you know, you'd expect him to hit 300 at some point just to be able to make up for the one something he was hitting early on. And so when you look at his numbers overall, like 245, 444 slugging, 118 OPS plus, like that's kind of, if you told me before the season that's where he would end up, that's where he would settle as a White Sox, I'd say great. Like, White Sox could use players like that, especially with a defense that's acceptable or better at third base. So I'm fine, like, cashing in that chip now. Like, it's a case of, like, selling stock. Like, yeah, I'll sell. I'll take the gains and be handsomely rewarded for it versus, like, do you keep riding with the stock and say, like, by the end of the year, he'll be hitting 280 because he's just going to keep doing what he's doing? That I'm not quite sure about, because, yeah, there needs to be adjustments to what he's doing. The thing that gives me hope is that he's always had good plate discipline. We saw even last year when he just could not put any just sock into the ball at all, when it was just not traveling far, not traveling fast off his bat, just didn't have the muscle. You could look at his numbers and say, like, well, he's swinging all the right pitches. Like, he's hitting it at the right launch angle, or he's getting the barrel to, like, the ball is just not traveling. But that's why I think everybody was scratching their head saying, like, well, you know, what's going on here? And, you know, they really emphasize strength training after the season. But that to me would be like a booing effect to where, like, they just can't sway. Oh, say, oh, we're just going to give you sliders and you're going to chase them all, because he hasn't been doing that. So,
yeah,
that's why I think I'm buying him as a contributor. I have no idea where his number is going to end up overall. Like, in terms of, you know, if, you know, we're looking at a 118 OPS now, OPS plus now, you know, it seemed like he had a 118 OPS last year. But if I were to say that gets up to like 125, I could buy that, by the end of the year. More than that, maybe more faith than I'm willing to give a White Sox acquisition, but I can't like put my finger on one thing that would make me say, like, oh, he's a pumpkin. He's going to fall apart in 4 weeks. And the dreams of him making an all-star team were silly. Like, I don't think that's going to happen. Just a matter of how much his natural talent allows him to be like star level versus a very good player.
Yeah, I think since he's made this hand adjustment in Minneapolis, he's cut down his strikeout rate below 15%, Jim. And for the season, his strikeout rate is only 17.7%. And his walk rate is 9%. I was one of those that didn't understand why the White Sox were making Miguel Vargas a priority in spring training. Because he looked so bad. So bad. And he was out of options. And theoretically, we signed Josh Rojas. Well, there's your third base solution, and you still got Brian Ramos.
Yeah, Ramos.
I thought Ramos going into the season would have been better than Miguel Vargas. And honestly, Vargas didn't do much to change people's opinion until that Minneapolis series in late April. I mean, he was batting well below 150. He's batting 137 on April 22nd. So he had a really bad start this year, not changing a lot of minds. And now, if he continues this rate for another 30 games, right, and if Shane Smith is having difficulty getting to the fifth inning, then the conversation changes of, well, Miguel Vargas is going to be the White Sox all-star representative. And if the White Sox, because of the StatCast data, Vargas does not move well to his right towards the foul line. That's why he's considered a below average when it comes to outs above average at third base, if you go to baseballsavant.com and look at the TrackMan data, the StatCast data, I apologize. But if the White Sox are confident in Vargas at first and he passes the eye test so far, well, I am sorry, Andrew Vaughn and Tim Elko, the White Sox have found their first base solution. It's Miguel Vargas, because your first baseman is slugging over 600, Jim. I mean, that's Frank Thomas territory. Like, we haven't seen that in a long time.
Well, I mean, in Vargas, when it comes to defensive runs saved, he's in the black there, one defensive run saved. And even Tom Tango, who is one of the senior architect, I think is his name, of StatCast, MLB Advanced Media, he says that, you know, StatCast outpaces defensive runs saved when it comes to the outfield. Like, their player tracking, ball tracking is superior to what they do. And so, like, he says that StatCast is way better predicting itself than defensive run saved is for like the next year. Whereas with infield, he still says infield is maybe a little bit better with defensive run save, that it just because they don't quite have the same amount of either data or just the amount that speed and routes and direction factors into outfield play. That, you know, because infield is more quick reactions and, you know, the glove being where it needs to be on time, that, you know, it's more of a art than science right now. And so defensive run saved is actually a little bit better than predicting future value at a defensive position than StatCast. So with that in mind, like, if he's average, I would call him average at this point. Like, I think he makes enough plays to make up for the ones he doesn't. And so it kind of all washes out. But like, keep him at third for the time being, but it's a case of like, if Brian Ramos comes on hot or Colson Montgomery keeps up what he's been doing since coming back from Arizona and one of them needs to play third, then you have your solution there with moving Vargas to first base. And he seems amenable to it. And also he probably seems open-minded enough, or at least experienced enough with playing different positions, that he could probably play first and then some third and go back and forth and not be too worse for the wear, versus like having giving him the Brooks Baldwin treatment of just like, all right, you're in the major leagues and you're playing five different positions. Good luck. And then just kind of all collapses. I don't think it's going to happen for Vargas going between first and third. So I would keep him at third and then just move him to first as need be. But I think right now that need doesn't be. And I think that's probably more of at least one or two infield promotions away from maybe making Vargas the first baseman and having your best defensive infield.
You do have position flexibility with Vargas now. Like, third and first, he can play both. That does help based on the matchups. If you are facing a left-handed pitcher and you want to sneak in another right-handed bat, like Lenin Sosa, for example, we talked about this in the previous podcast episode, James laying it out and how it's going to work at first base for the White Sox with Vaughn and Elko down in Charlotte. Just moving forward, this is why if he can carry this for another 30 games, I might be sold and my tune will totally change. It's amazing and just how one little trick, isn't that the SEO headline?
Yeah, one weird
watch
trick.
Watch this one little trick by Miguel Vargas, and suddenly he's a completely different player for the White Sox. I mean, 1.6 war in 31 games, Jim?
Yeah.
That's all-star level.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, to go back to our previous conversations, it's like one weird trick that required like six different steps of progress to be able to set up that one weird trick. So can't do it at home exactly. But where are you in terms of this conversation? You asked me in terms of, are you buying into it, or like, where do you see him ending up? So where are you in terms of where you think he is, if you had to like be one of your, place one of your wagers right now that you place?
I think I'd be buying stock in Miguel Vargas, because whether it's the high fast, he's hitting the high fastball, Jim.
Yeah.
And that's been a pitch that gave him a lot of issues. And that's why he just looked like he was floundering early on. But again, his strikeout rate, being able to cut it that low, just demonstrates that he not only is demonstrating good contact skills within the strike zone, Jim, but he's able to make good contact of good pitches that are in the shadow area or what would be considered chase, like being able to survive and getting the ball in play. If he was doing this with a 30% strikeout rate, I would just say he's on a heater. Because as soon as he's not on a heater, then we know what that result is. It's Luis Robert Jr. And White Sox fans are getting more and more frustrated with Luis Robert. To be completely sold and say he is part of the core, congratulations, Chris Getz. You're right. I was wrong. Good on you to stay stubborn and continuing pushing Miguel Vargas. You have found a core piece that you can build a new offense around. I need to see that in the next 30 games and see if it can continue. But it's been so promising these last 31 games, and so promising against the Mets. You can't see this like on paper and the metrics, but watching him, Jim, he just seems way more confident now. And it's just not at the plate, but it is defense and even base running as well, being able to score from first base. We're seeing a completely different Miguel Vargas than the one the White Sox traded for last year.
Yeah, he had a little, or he had a couple moments of heat checks, like the ball that went off the top of the wall. He thought that was gone. Ended up still getting a double out of it, so it's not like he started walking to first and then got stranded there. Also ran into an out at third base. So he's had a couple moments of like testing it and seeing like just how far he can go. And the 38'3" that he's putting up. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, and he has a license to do that. That's a case of him being good enough and him seemingly involved in every single big White Sox inning to think, I can change this game by myself. And so you don't necessarily mind doing that. We've also seen him, jawing with Brad Keller. So it seems like he's feeling licensed more to define himself on the field. James just wrote a great story about him being a basically a hardcore Vikings fan, and other ways he's been able to stand out in terms of like his sense of humor, high-pitched barks in the dugout to imitate a chihuahua when he's like trying to psych guys up. It's just the guy that there was no evidence of him being last year when he was sitting at the edge of the dugout just staring off 1,000 yards in the distance, and Dodgers fans were heartbroken saying like, what did we do to this guy, sending him to the White Sox? Like that guy does not seem to exist anymore. So major credit for him to be able to close the door on a pretty ugly chapter and pretty convincingly saying that, that guy is not me. I am entirely different and I have arrived.
It's a breath of fresh air being able to make this transformation. I mean, we've been dogging on players that have struggled and point out their struggles and wondering what in the world is going on. How come this player can't fix it? No better example than Andrew Vaughn. I have no problem eating crow when a player makes this type of transformation. It's just so rare for the White Sox. Like, I was completely wrong in Garrett Kershaw. Huge breath of fresh air. He dominated last year as a starter. Didn't see that coming. I don't think anyone really could say how that would have worked, but it totally did. Miguel Vargas was not hitting to start the season. And now look at him.
I think it was Chuck Garfine who was saying like, there are so many receipts online, and like, yeah, P people had eyes. People could look at him in the field. They could look at him, the White Sox casting him in left field for a little bit and saying, like, God, that didn't work. And then, you know, his play at third base wasn't what it is this year. And his, you know, he hadn't hit with the Dodgers really.
Not in the majors.
A few major league auditions. Yeah, in the majors. Yeah. So, I mean, like, there was Evan's thing, like, oh, this is all falling apart. This is a prospect the White Sox have seen before. And Vargas did nothing to back that up. Yeah, aside from, like, the swing decisions being okay, but everything else was lacking. And so, like, who was supposed to say Vargas is going to be a good one? Like, people were, you know, the most he could get anybody to say was, I really believed in him as a prospect. And maybe the trade did something terrible to him, but like they were only speaking of like what he or his selling points in the past tense in terms of what he had been. But that guy was not evident in the major league. So, everybody's eating crow. I guess my issue with the trade was like trading a guy who, for a guy who's out of options when like Lenin Sosa's out of options and you have really painting yourself in a corner with this and somehow they got out of it.
Vargas already has a career high in home runs. The Dodgers gave Vargas a long run. They gave him half a season, 81 games in 2023.
Yeah.
He only hit 7 homers. Vargas already has 8 this year. So he has already set a single season career high in home runs hit.
Yeah. I mean, he's had a few.
I'm sure the Dodgers were probably like, this is the version that we hoped for, but we didn't see this version.
Yeah. And I mean, the Dodgers, because Vargas is out of options and because their roster is so loaded, like they couldn't afford to do what they had been doing with him, which is to give him like spurts of playing time when somebody else gets hurt. So I doubt that they're regretting the trade at all. I mean, Michael Kopech helped them win a World Series. So, I mean, like they've won their side of it, but I think people who had bought into Vargas being like some form of bats, you know, I think his position was always in question, but like he should hit enough to play somewhere, even if he's a third baseman, you kind of have to hold your nose when you're watching play or can hit okay enough to be a first baseman, you know, kind of flex out in a DH and such. But the way his game is entirely shaped up, like testament to him, testament to, you know, White Sox coaches to be able to have a whole host of either ideas or at least like a process. That's kind of what it seemed like. It was not necessarily like, we're just going to throw everything against the wall, but we're going to change one variable at a time. You know, first your physical build, you know, make sure that you have the strength because you lost a lot of weight. And then, you know, once that's solved, okay, now what else is wrong? Okay. So bat path, let's shorten that up. Okay. So you're getting this, but you're a little bit, short to the ball and you're not getting a whole lot behind it. Let's try to lengthen it. Okay, let's change your hand. Like, just it seemed like they had a process or a reason to what they're doing in each step, and everything they did addressed something. And then it was just a matter of finding the one thing that closed that fatal flaw. And now he's a pretty well-rounded hitter.
And kudos to Vargas being open to those type of adjustments. You know, athletes can be, they can close off if nothing is working. You're telling me to do all these things. I'm still not hitting the baseball. Why am I listening to you? Let me go get outside help. So kudos to Vargas being adaptable. It does make me wonder how come the White Sox can't fix Andrew Vaughn, but regardless, it's working great.
I think that's a levers problem.
Yeah. There's plenty of guys in Major League Baseball that are 5'10 and shorter that still hit the ball with authority.
But I think they just have more bat speed. So it's a term of So opposite field homers in college are an opposite field homers in the pros. You know, maybe that's my thought on him is just when you don't have the natural leverage you're generating, you got to be like, you know, Altuve is the classic example, but like he gets the bat through the zone in a hurry.
Right.
And puts all his force doing that. And so I think that's with Vaughn, I think it's just physical limitations that did not translate well. And I'm curious with bat tracking data, if he would be somebody who would be regarded differently going from college to the pros if you were drafted like this year.
Yeah, he definitely would have one of our best friends Jim Callis I think just mocked Jace Laviolette to pick 20. So the top preseason college hitter continues to drop because of that type of analysis, bat data as far as contact data, swing analysis. We just talked about that in the previous podcast episode with Mike Farron about this upcoming college draft class and the NCAA regionals, which starts this weekend. You guys could definitely check out that podcast episode. But Miguel Vargas continued to do this because this is exciting, a great development for the White Sox. An unexpected development for the Chicago White Sox, and I have no idea, Jim, how this has come to be. But watching Adrian Hauser after his two starts, he went six scoreless innings again against the Mets. He pitched into the seventh inning. He allowed a base runner. Brandon Iser was able to come into the game and get out of the jam. So Hauser now, two starts, no runs allowed. He's only allowed five hits. It's four walks to eight strikeouts, so it's not a lot of strikeouts. Where is this coming from?
It seems like the stuff ticked up and, you know, James wrote about a little bit that he got some power back, and it's a little bit similar to Shane Smith.
Okay.
Becoming like a Rule 5, you know, or somebody who was exposed to the Rule 5 draft by the Brewers, and then he's picked first by the White Sox, and then he shows up at spring training like throwing 97, and you're like, well, how did the Brewers give up on this guy or not protect him? It's like, well, he didn't do that before. And I think with Hauser, it's a little bit of the same thing. Not so dramatic, but I think, you know, looking at his velocity, he was throwing 91 and 94, or 94.1, 94.3 with the Brewers. Then it dipped down more to 93 sinker, not as effective, you know, being 92 in his last year at the Brewers. Sinker's now 94. So I think that just, it's almost like turning back the clock a little bit and getting back to where he was when he was a capable starter in the Brewers organization. So yeah, it's not necessarily out of nowhere. I think two scoreless outings of six innings. It was funny. I thought of his arrival and just him showing up fully formed, capable of throwing six plus innings, having a history of throwing a full starter's workload. It reminded me of Johnny Cueto in terms of him being found money. And then, like, sure enough, like Cueto also threw, you know, scoreless outings his first two times out, just immediately looked like a godsend. I forgot it was like that good from the gate. But similar in terms of just, oh, we don't have to try to, matriculate a starter from AAA to the majors on the fly. We can just pick up a fully formed, credible mid rotation starter, plug him right in and we're fine. And, that's a pretty neat trick, but yeah, the slot, the sinker is more powerful. And then it seems like the curve is what's emerged from like being the sinker slider guy he was in Milwaukee to being somebody who's a little bit better than he seemed to be, even like during his heyday with the Brewers. So, two neat tricks. And, you know, as James wrote, like he worked out at the same facility Davis Martin did. So it's like, it's a case of perhaps some word of mouth or perhaps, who's thrown with this guy, you know, when we're looking at AAA starters. And it's amazing that he has turned out as well as he did, because that is such a bullet the White Sox dodged, not having to go to their AAA depth for a starter. Like if they had to go to who would it even be, like Owen White?
Because they cut Justin Dunn.
Yeah, and even Clevenger's hurt. He's on the aisle. So, you know, as much as Clevenger would be the even the cynical option, like he's not available. Evan McKendry is the guy throwing recently, but like even then he's topping out at four innings. Nastrini's in the bullpen.
Shultons.
Shultons just got rocked. He's rehabbing, but like he's been beat up in AAA so far coming back from Tommy John surgery. So who would be the guy? Like there isn't an easy question. So like the fact that they just, you know, that I think that's the reason why they probably were pretty aggressive in saying like, hey, Adrian Hauser, and you're going from AAA opting out and getting a guaranteed major league deal the rest of the year versus like somebody else's minor league deal that they can parlay into a major league job, like a, you know, two-way contract or something like that. Like, nope, we're just going to give you a guaranteed deal sight unseen. You're in the rotation now. And, you know, kudos to them for, taking that chance. But also I think because of just how, ramshackle the Charlotte rotation is, they really had no choice but to look at what Hauser was doing and say, hey, this is better than anybody else we have in Charlotte. If this is what it takes to get him, we got to get him.
I was thinking to myself while watching Hauser in his second start against the Mets, how many teams are texting Chris Getz right now? Just watching Hauser. Yeah. Like, the Houston Astros just lost a starting pitcher for the rest of the season. I'm wondering, like, over under 3.5 teams that texted Chris Getz, Jim, during Hauser's start against the Mets. I'm sure it's got to be, because again, he's pitching so well. It's probably taken everyone's attention. Like, where did this guy come from? Hold on. Anyone could have had him, and he's throwing mm-hmm. this well, and the stuff looks really good. And to your point, it's gained a couple of ticks in velocity. I mean, Hauser's getting traded, right? Like, we're here for a fun time, not a long time.
Yeah. I mean, like, I would assume so if the White Sox had an interest in keeping him, and I don't know if they want to spend. Yeah, I don't know if they want to get a bidding war for a starter in his 30s who isn't like a strikeout guy right now. I think they'd probably just keep going to the bargain bin for that while they try to shape up their internal rotation. But to me, I'm thinking of him as like what Mike Soroka was supposed to be last year. Just a sinker baller, supposed to be past his injuries and rejuvenated. And we saw like what he was throwing at the end of last year. We can fix him or build him up a little bit more, and teams might want him at the end of the year, and that didn't happen. And I think Hauser, being that he hasn't had any kind of major injury setting him back, that's just been what seemed like a pretty graceful or normal decline from a number four-ish starter to being somebody who's kind of on the cusp, needing minor league deals. You know, there's nothing unreasonable about the way his career has unfolded so far, and the fact that he's got 5 years of service time, it does put him in that Soroka territory of just, you know, he's going to be a free agent at the end of the year. We can trade him if a team wants him and then get him back if we really want to pay for it. But I think, you know, probably in order to capitalize on it, they already traded Matt Theis for Drew Baker. And like Drew Baker is not necessarily anybody who's going to be a starter on the roster or like plug a hole. I think if they want to try to capitalize, they needed to trade Theis to a certain degree because of a time crunch. But I think with Hauser, they need him to, for Will Venable's sake.
Yeah.
Need somebody to throw starts. He can still build up his value further. It makes sense to, there's no reason to like try to trade him, found money. Let's trade him for like a William Bergoya or something like that. You can hold on to him for a little bit more. He's serving purpose now. And, I think teams want to make sure that like going back to the pumpkin thing, like that the league doesn't figure him out like, this is what to look for now. And then they start hammering him again. And he's just kind of a number four starter again. So I think teams want to look a little bit more to see like if this is the real deal. And I'm sure the White Sox want to hold on a little bit more because they need them right now. They're not in a position to shed starters with what they have in AAA. Like that's just a miserable viewing and playing experience if they try to bring it up from Charlotte. And if it continues to progress, or even if it's just like he is number three starter, number four starter, still has value when the deadline comes around.
Oh, absolutely. Again, I think it's more teams texting Chris Getz, where the hell did this guy come from? I think it's more like that right now than Chris Getz like showcasing, be like, who wants Adrian Hauser? It's an awesome start for Hauser, and he'll get another opportunity for the White Sox this upcoming weekend against Baltimore. Again, we'll preview that series in a moment. You mentioned Matt Theis being traded to Tampa for Drew Baker. Theis ended up playing 35 games with the White Sox. He batted just .212, but his 20.9% walk rate carried his OPS, a .382 on base percentage, even though he slugged just .294. Theis did hit a home run and 8 RBIs. Remember Matt Theis at the end of the year Sporacle when you're trying to guess who all played for the Chicago White Sox this season. You good with the deal? I mean, this is something that James Fegan got a tip a couple of weeks ago. This exact trade that was being rumored, the Rays waited a couple more weeks before pulling the trigger and finalizing this trade. Do you like this move by the White Sox?
Well, I think it's a matter of like they had to wait for Corey Lee to get healthy to make sure that they weren't going to have Kyle Teal and Edgar Caro in the same catching rotation. And because I think right now they're both being individually served by being on different levels. And like if Corey Lee wasn't going to be healthy because they seem to not be huge believers in his catching abilities that, you know, they probably want to make sure Tice is around, that they don't trade him unnecessarily. And then Drew Baker was hurt. So if the White Sox were kind of interested in him, you know, he had to come back from an adductor strain and he was rehabbing it for a week in the Florida Complex League. So probably both sides had an idea of what they wanted and both sides needed the timing to line up better to make sure that, you know, they were still in on each other's players. But yeah, I mean, like that was kind of always going to be the idea, was that, you know, maybe can dust Theis off a little bit and trade him for somebody. They got him for cash from the Cubs, trade him for somebody who might be able to contribute to a 26-man roster at some point. Like, not a bad deal. I enjoyed watching Theis hit. I thought he was really, like a really, I wrote about this Thursday afternoon, just saying like, he was a really interesting player in terms of how many walks he could draw for the how little power he showed. And I think, you know, he would hit more than one homer if he played the season over again. Like, he's just a matter of a little bit of a luck or small sample size, but also he shortened up his swing. Another guy who made swing changes to overcome just swing and miss issues that undermined his ability to hang in the majors for anything, you know, any meaningful role. So he had a change in mind. He had overlapped with a couple of White Sox coaches. So good fit for him. Imagine the White Sox had like an idea of what his game was and either what it could be or his willingness to make changes. Whether they would work is a whole different matter. But just knowing like, oh, he's a guy who works. He's a guy who is open to making some changes because we've seen him at various stages. And yeah, it was a nice little trick of just a month and a half of Matt Theis turns into a Drew Baker. You know, perhaps if Theis continued to show this, you know, maybe he can get a little bit more. But given, you know, Corey Lee coming back, given that Theis's time is already limited, like he's going to be traded by July no matter what, because Kyle Teal looks like he's on a mission in Charlotte. You have Edgar Caro. Like, Matt Theis was going to be like 4 months at best. Like, you're hoping for him to get traded because of just that would mean Kyle Teal and Edgar Caro and or Edgar Caro are ready to roll and you like what they're showing. And that's the case. Like, everybody's looking good. Theis is looking good. Caro's looking good enough. Teal's looking great at Charlotte. Even Corey Lee, I think, is overachieving and making himself, he's trying to make the White Sox like him. And I think he's doing what he can. And I think the White Sox respect that to a certain degree. Even if they always seem to regard his game calling or framing like a little bit of a backhanded swipe. But I think it's whether Baker turns into anything is, yeah, not a long shot, but I would say like, yeah, maybe give him a 40% chance of like being on a good White Sox team or 30% chance of being on a good White Sox team. I think it's still fine for the odds of Theis being as good as he was and the odds of the White Sox batting 1,000 with the catchers, in that because every catcher looks good, somebody has to go and Theis is the one who can return value at this point.
Well, let's move over to the White Sox bullpen. This is a bullpen by numbers type of conversation. The White Sox could not hold a one run lead. There was no margin error for that game. To Jim's point early on in the show, the White Sox would have to shut out the Mets, and that's really hard. However, Cam Boozer and Steven Wilson are veterans, and they really need to own these high leverage opportunities with the White Sox. Because again, if they pitch better, they could be moved at the deadline to teams looking to add bullpen depth. They have an opportunity to prove themselves worthy of playing for a team that's trying to make the postseason rather than the White Sox, who are currently still in the bottom of the American League. And like, Wilson this month of May has more walks than strikeouts. If you look at his season numbers, he's got a 2.20 ERA, and people will say that's really good. Jim, his FIP is 5.27. That's a gigantic difference. Boozer only has a 67% left on base rate, which is not great for a reliever. Only Jared Schuster and the injured Miguel Castro have lower left on base rates than Boozer. In May, that drops down to 60%. So I think going into the series against Baltimore in the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be focused on how Cam Boozer and Steven Wilson pitch, Jim. because, again, these guys are veterans. They have to own these roles. They have to own these opportunities. This is not something like Ethan Katz or Brian Bannister can coach up these two guys. Like, really, for them, it's now or never. Like, if you can't prove that you can handle these situations with the White Sox, you're going to be with the White Sox the rest of the season. I don't know if you're going to come back to pitch for the White Sox. And if you can't pitch for the White Sox, are you even going to be in Major League Baseball? Shout out to old friend Jake Diekman. He retired as somebody that frustrated White Sox fans and just not able to own those type of leverage situations. So when it comes to the White Sox bullpen conversation, that's how I'm like narrowing my focus, Jim. It's on Boozer and Wilson.
Yeah, Boozer's a little bit difficult to assess because he's so old for how little service time he's accrued. Like, he looks and when you watch him pitch, like, he feels like somebody who's been around, 33 years old now, just turned 33 earlier this month. And he still like has a year of service time, or like less than a year of service time. Like, arbitration is not going to happen. Like, there's no reason for the White Sox to lock him up to, you know, buy out his age 38 year. Like, that's kind of what you're talking about when it comes to like the timetable he's on. It was so severely delayed because of his like long story that he has all the, you know, markings, I guess, when you're watching him, of somebody who should be traded. But he's also a case of like, well, he could hang around for a bit. Like, if he's still a project in terms of learning how to get major league hitters out, learning how to harness his stuff in different situations, you know, you can, as much as you'd like to see him be like an instant fix, because the White Sox did trade for him and because they need so much bullpen help, and he does have the stuff to have some really easy innings, that it should be easier for him. But, you know, service time, it's still like a case of he's basically still a rookie. Like, he, you know, he exceeded his limits, but basically he's still working on his first full season. He's pitched between Boston and Chicago. He's now pitched 67 games, 62 innings. So that's basically a full season of major league experience. So when you look at it that way, you could say that he's still learning. Steven Wilson, though, he's been around. He's lived a life with the White Sox already in terms of, you know, having some big setbacks, trying to change his arsenal, then having to reset it and getting hurt and, you know, walking guys. And just now it's a little bit of a home run problem a little bit, but just it's because he's been so varied in the way he's disappointed since coming over in that whole San Diego trade. Looks like everybody was kind of damaged goods or not themselves when they came over. That, it seems like a matter of, because he's ARB eligible, because the White Sox already outrighted him once, and so they can't do it again or else becomes a free agent, his status is a lot more tenuous. So when it comes to the White Sox offering him ARB again, when it comes to the White Sox wanting him off the 40-man roster again, should things take a turn, then that's, I think, where, you know, his status is a lot dicier than Boozer's, which is a pretty straightforward, oh, he's still figuring it out. And seeing the walks flare up on Wilson when I thought like, oh, he's not walking anybody anymore. He's kind of learned, he's dialed in the sweeper. It's looking pretty good. And then like, yeah, the walks become an issue. And yeah, just it, he had a home run problem earlier. He's got a walking problem now. So it always feels like a little bit of whack-a-mole in terms of just feeling like he's finally righted the ship.
One guy I would like to see maybe get more high leverage situations, and he definitely did on the Monday game, is Brandon Eisert. So in the month of May, Eisert has a 28.6% strikeout rate. That's really good for a reliever. And he's leaving guys on base at a 77% clip. It's just going to be the shuffle for the White Sox bullpen. Just go with the hot hand. I'm curious, instead of having Boozer pitch the eighth, do you give Eisert those opportunities to see if he can execute a little bit better than Cam Boozer? Mike Vassell is doing well in this swingman role, Jim. Three scoreless innings on Wednesday. I'm not exactly sure how he is doing it, because his strikeout rate is not great. It's around 16%. His walk rate is at 14%. You do the math, he's got almost as many walks as strikeouts. That's not good in the majors. But opposing hitters are just batting 187 against him. And he's got two very effective pitches right now. His sweeper against right-handed batters, according to Stuff Plus, gets a 111 rating. So it's much like OPS plus and weighted runs created plus. It's 11% better than league average on a sweeper. Right-handed batters are only batting 125 against Vassell sweeper. And then lefties, his changeup has been very good against left-handed batters. Lefties are only batting 136 against Mike Vassell's changeup. So maybe this is another guy who's got one or two good tricks that's working for the White Sox with Mike Vassell, but I wouldn't put him in high leverage situations, but he seems to be pretty effective in this swingman role, Jim.
Yeah, given that he's a Rule 5 pick and that he has to be on the roster, when it comes to Rule 5 picks, I think, you know, Shane Smith might have spoiled some people a little bit, but I think this is more, you look at a pitcher and say, like, oh, he's going to be low leverage. He's going to be a swingman. He's going to be picking up innings that nobody else wants. Like the Dylan Covey experience, which is,
yeah,
he was a Rule 5 pick. The White Sox had to gut through a season with him, and then they gutted through a few others because it never quite clicked for him. But that was the idea of just, he's going to soak up some starts. He's going to come in when he can't screw up a game. Might be ugly sometimes, but we believe in the stuff. We're going to get through a full season. And so Vassell right now, I think, you know, he did get that save situation in Cincinnati and handled it because of just the order, or the part of the order that was coming up, the fit versus handedness, because he is susceptible to lefties. But I think with the way he's coming into games now, earlier in games, like picking up, you know, three innings after a Shane Smith start, picking up three innings against the Marlins, picking up three innings against the Athletics, like he's been able to come in against lineups that aren't necessarily gearing up for him. And I think that probably helps him too. You know, he's doing well for himself with his arsenal, like, you know, sinker, sweeper, not missing a ton of bats, but he's throwing enough pitches that he's able to offer some different sequences. And, you know, it's more along lines of like a number five starter, number four starter, pitching in the bullpen. And so he's kind of taking that approach of throwing all my pitches and, not necessarily trying to be a dominant two pitch guy. And I think that's probably working. It also seems like he's flying under the radar enough that teams aren't going to load up on lefties to face Mike Vassell in the fifth inning when they might be facing a tougher reliever later. So it's working out to his advantage. And I think his length as somebody with starting experience is such that if it's going, then he keeps pitching, you know, versus somebody who after two innings, you know, Will Venable starts like getting a little itchy in terms of like, oh, is he going to start wearing down or is he going to have a second time through the order type penalty for him? Like, no, I think it's a matter of, because he's picking up these non-crucial innings or innings opponents see as non-crucial, that he's able to get in some nice situations and take the ball and run with it.
Well, now the Chicago White Sox move on to this weekend, the battle of the two worst teams in the American League. One was expected, the other, not so much, as the White Sox head to Baltimore. The Orioles are 19-36 on the season. They are 16 games back of the New York Yankees. They are going to be sellers at the trade deadline. They are in last place in the American League East. They lost their last two games. They're 4-6 in their last 10. They have not been good at home. They are 9-17 at Camden Yards. Offensively, when it comes to team OPS, the Orioles are at 689. That's 19th in Major League Baseball. They got too much talent offensively to be hitting this poorly. They're 10th in baseball in home runs hit. They've hit 60 home runs as a team, but they're only scoring 3.87 runs per game. Again, just too much offensive talent to be performing this poorly. But the story is the pitching and just how awful the pitching has been for Baltimore. The starter ERA for the Orioles is 5.60. That's 28th in Major League Baseball. And the bullpen, not much better. The reliever ERA is 5.38. That's 26th in Major League Baseball. The White Sox will have the advantage on the pitching side in this series. The pitching problems for this weekend. Friday night, 6.05 p.m. Central Time start. Sean Burke will get the ball as he revisits Maryland. That's where you play college baseball against Zach Eflin. Eflin's got a 5.40 ERA this season. Saturday afternoon, this is a 3.05 p.m. Central Time start. The Dart, Davis Martin will get the ball for the White Sox against Dean Kramer of the Orioles. He's got an ERA above 5. And on Sunday, June 1st, this is a 12.35 p.m. Central Time start. Adrian Hauser will get the ball, his third start with the White Sox, against Charlie Morton, who's got an ERA over 7 and is 1-7 on the season. just really eye-opening stuff. And Jim, when it comes to the Orioles, they already fired their manager, Brandon High. We talked about that in a previous podcast episode. If things do not turn around this season, I'm expecting even more firings for the Baltimore Orioles, especially in the front office. Wouldn't be surprised if they have a general manager opening after the season with just how bad things have gotten for the Orioles. But I already know this is going to be brought up because this is what happens in Chicago, especially with draft lotteries, with hockey and basketball. The Bulls missed out on a chance of getting the number one pick because what? They beat the Mavericks late at the season, and now they're going to be drafting in the teens. I already know that White Sox fans come the winter meetings in Orlando that they're going to be saying, oh, the White Sox, they should have not won that series in Baltimore. They would have got a better chance to have the number one pick. The case to not care about the draft lottery at this moment in the month of May. You can go to tankathon.com/MLB, great resource. You can play the little simulator. The White Sox have the best odds to getting the number one pick, the same odds as the Baltimore Orioles at 22.27%. What you will notice, though, the Rockies can't have a top 10 pick or better than 10th overall because they've been in the top five the last 2 years. The Angels and the Nationals also don't qualify to have a top 10 pick. So really, there's only five teams this upcoming draft lottery that have a better odds of 10% and getting the number one overall pick. That's the White Sox, Orioles, Pirates, Athletics, and Marlins. So don't worry about the draft lottery in May. I'm trying to get ahead of this conversation, Jim, because I know someone's going to bring up the White Sox sweep the Orioles and they get the third overall pick. White Sox fans are like, oh man, if they didn't win that series in Baltimore, they could have had the number one overall pick. Don't worry about it.
Now, two things about that. One is, you know, if Sean Burke, Davis Martin, Adrian Hauser all pitch well, and that's the reason why they won the series, like everybody should want them to pitch well for multiple reasons, like Burke and Martin looking like credible major league starters, Hauser looking like somebody they can trade. So, like, you know, why lose those games? Also, I think the trump card in this argument is that the White Sox set the record for losses in a modern major league season last year. And they were prohibited from picking higher than 10th because of lottery rules. But even if they weren't, they would have picked 6th. Just the way the lottery shook out is, for all the losing they did last year, if they were allowed to pick 1st, they wouldn't have picked 1st. They would have picked 6th because of the way the balls had shaken out. So that's why when it comes to the odds, it really does seem like the anti-tanking measures have worked in that there's no reason to race a team for the most losses and artificially make those losses happen because that hasn't really been rewarded. And I think because of, you know, like you mentioned with the Rockies being out of it, like that's one team that's going to be out of their way. They have enough going wrong for them, especially if they had sell once again the trade deadline to where like they're not going to be winning 70 games this year to screw things up. So they should be in decent shape to have the odds they need to at least give themselves a reasonable shot. And if it doesn't work out, it's because like just that's just the way the Major League Baseball draft is engineered to not reward that. And it certainly would have worked last year. And, you know, imagine, yeah, I think White Sox fans were so resigned to, oh, you can't pick higher than 10th, that story slipped under the radar. But yeah, imagine if they did have the chance to pick first, everybody's talking about, well, at least we'll get the first pick and then you get 6th. And then just imagine, you know, how many, people would have been defenestrating themselves on social media because that happened.
Why do the baseball gods hate us? Yeah. So don't worry about the draft lottery, but this weekend, the one thing I am looking forward to, Jim, runs. I feel a good goal, even though this hurts me in the steak dinner bet. At least 15 runs scored in these three games combined. More than that. Average, more than 5 runs per game. Baltimore is so bad on the run prevention side. If the White Sox stumble and they struggle to score runs against the Orioles, I'm not going to feel great when we have to record a new podcast episode on Sunday night. So they should be able to score.
Does that help your steak dinner bet, though?
I mean, it does help me in the steak dinner bet, but this is the weekend with Baltimore. I want this White Sox team to take advantage of a team that's doing an awful job at run prevention like Baltimore. It's different because the Mets, the fact that White Sox scored 14 runs in three games against the Mets, who have the best, one of the best starting rotations in all of Major League Baseball. And sure, nine of those came off of Griffin Canning in that Wednesday game. We knew that was going to be a struggle for the White Sox to score, but yet they were competitive in those two games against the Mets that they lost. Here against Baltimore, I'm expecting high scoring games, but the White Sox really should be able to take advantage of this poor pitching staff.
Yeah, the Orioles have allowed the third most runs, and the two teams ahead of them or behind them, however you look at it. One is the Rockies, of course, and then the other is the Athletics, who are playing in a very wonky stadium that nobody likes. So, the Orioles are playing in a quote-unquote normal park, even though they've messed with it a little bit in terms of their left field wall, and they look terrible. And, yeah, part of me wants to see the White Sox offense, you know, eat one because it's like enjoyable. But also, like, beyond that, just the, you know, seeing the Orioles being such an obvious trade partner for first Dylan Cease and then Garrett Crochet and never coming close to offering a fair price. Like the Red Sox, they ponied up. Like the Red Sox paid the price for Garrett Crochet. And when you see what the Padres paid for Dylan Cease, it's like, sure, you're going to beat that, Baltimore? Like, even with, you know, Heston Kerstad or something like that being maybe the lead player back, and he's not looking great. But, like, you know, seeing a poor process or a poor philosophy when it comes to capitalizing on a good team and addressing a weakness punished like this is very satisfying. And so to see, like, the White Sox, you know, because, like, Garrett Crochet looks great in Boston. Like, he's not the reason why they're scuffling, that they're a terrible defensive team. It turns out that now Bregman's hurt, so that's a blow. But, like, they're, you know, god awful defensively, more errors than the White Sox, leading the entire league in errors. But Crochet looks like the guy they traded for, and both teams, I think, are happy with what they dealt and what they received. And there's nothing stopping the Orioles from doing something like that, and at least putting at least plugging one hole in the rotation. They had a few. Like, Garrett Crochet would not be able to solve everything wrong with the Orioles rotation, but at least be a point of evidence that the Orioles front office saw how bad it was and anticipated a problem and tried to solve it, versus I think Mike Elias is in trouble just because he did nothing. And everybody was saying, like, are you sure you want to be counting on Grayson Rodriguez after two IL stints last year? And Cal Bradish is hurt and Charlie Morton's 41. Like, are you sure these are good bets to provide the value you think you're going to need to compete in the AL East? And just did nothing. And David Rubenstein, new owner, did nothing. So I guess, you know, it's a cautionary tale for the White Sox, thinking that Justin Ishbia, whoever, is going to solve things. But, just it really seemed like Elias was either high on his own supply or just thinking that, we can out-hit anything. And, you know, they're not really special offensively this year. And not terrible, but not special offensively. And they really need to be like, Yankees grade offense to overcome the pitching set that they have.
Their offense is underachieving. Like, you go on Fangraphs and they've got four or five guys that are well above league average offensively. You should not be averaging below four runs per game when you got Ryan O'Hearn, who's already worth two WAR this season. And he's got a weighted runs created plus over like 180. Like, when you're getting that type of production from Ryan O'Hearn, I mean, that should be the cherry on the top. Like, you already have so much talent on the position player side. Like, it's just a perfect storm. The pitching, worst case scenario, the offense not even playing up to their 40th percentile projection, like, really underachieving.
Oh, like, Tyler O'Neill was their big addition, and he's been bad. So, like, on both sides of the ball, they didn't really do anything to invest in supplements. And they're counting on, you know, Ryan O'Hearn nuclear mode, which I think is, it's still astounding. And I think that's something with reminds me that Ryan Fuller was fired by the Orioles, fired or not renewed or something like that. Like, it's really seemed like you always say parting of ways, but I think it was probably a parting of ways. They got rid of both their hitting coaches. One is now advising the White Sox, another one is hitting coach for the Twins. And so they pulled that card already. They fired their manager, so they've they're out of scapegoats, basically. Like, you know, what are they
well,
gonna
Elias
do?
Is out of scapegoats. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, like, yeah, they have one big scapegoat remaining, and that's the person who they turn that position over. And then all of a sudden, it's a brand new ball game. But yeah, there were warning signs, and they just, yeah, I think Elias whistled past them, and it really is. You know, we've seen it with the White Sox. So that's what the White Sox did. They had a good team in 2021 and really didn't do much to add to it. They were so concerned about losing Eloy Jimenez and Luis Robert and Yoan Moncada to free agency. We got to lock these guys up because we lock these guys up, we can't pay anybody else. And because they're terrible, we can't trade them. And now we're, you know, just, we're all going to spiral downwards together. The Orioles have not locked anybody up, but they still acted the same way in that we cannot move from any of these guys, or we cannot spend because these guys are going to get expensive. And same story.
Again, the White Sox were 5-21 in April when we recorded that podcast episode at the beginning of May. They're already 11-15. So I know Sean Anderson, a CGO, was trying to will the White Sox to a winning record in May. This has already been so much more palatable to watch the White Sox in the month of May. It'd be a great way to end this month if they win this series in Baltimore. Let's make it happen.
Yeah.
Win 2 out of 3.
They've already won more games in a month than they did it all last year. They topped out at 10 in September.
There you go.
So they're already ahead of schedule.
Ahead of schedule. That's what we like to see and hear. And that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. Again, we'll recap this Baltimore series and all the weekend action. We'll take a look around Major League Baseball in our Sunday episode. Again, if you are going to be interested in watching college baseball, so much baseball this weekend. It's going to start at 11 a.m. and go all the way through midnight, including the Major League games and the minor league games, baseball overload this weekend. You can check out our previous podcast episode with Mike Farron. And you can subscribe to the Sox Machine Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also watch our videos. I'll be trying to get as much video as possible on draft prospects this weekend during regional play. You can watch those highlights on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. You can follow James Fegan at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh on Blue Sky. We made it easy. SoxMachine.com, JRFegan.SoxMachine.com, or Josh.SoxMachine.com. If you love our work and you want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox, Major League Baseball, and the draft, you can sign up at SoxMachine.com. $5 a month gets you an ad-free version of both the podcast and the website, unlocks the comment section as well. We have additional tiers of support. If you want to hear the trade gossip and the whispers that James Fegan is hearing, you can join our veterans committee. We've got some spots open. Again, if you're interested, go to SoxMachine.com and sign up today. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.